Will come to order. Sorry about the delay. We have a lot of bills that have a lot of concerns this morning. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 260A. We will not be taking testimony this morning on this bill. Committee, 260A has an amendment, a dash 5, I believe.
We have a dash 5 amendment, Madam Chair, and includes the conflict amendments. The bill had conflicts with House Bill 2306 as well as Senate Bill 253. You can walk you through those,
sure,
those sections. I feel like the dash 5 includes the section 1A, which deals with House Bill 2306 amendments. This is pages 8 through 19, which deals basically with definitions. 2306 has actually already been signed by the president. It's on its way to the governor's desk, so it's further along in the process than our bill. So what it does is it integrates our section 1 with the definition sections, which is ORS 746-600. They add in some additional definitions that don't actually impact our bill, but impact the other bill. So this, all the definitions are all done in this particular statute. And I can show you which numbers go and how detailed do you want to get.
just briefly go through the section.
On page 9, the bold lines 14 through 17 are added because of the dash 5s, which are the amendments we're adopting. Read off. Again, there's some changes on page 10 added because of the dash 5. On page 10, the last line 30 is added. Covered entity means that definition is added because of House Bill 2306. And then on page 11, the bold on lines 9 through 15 is from the dash 5. That's language we're inserting. On 23 through 30 on page 11, there's language from 2306, which adds definitions about what healthcare means, healthcare operations. Pages 12, 13, 14, and half of 15 are all because of House Bill 2306, as well as lines 15 through 17 on page 15 are from the dash 5. The rest of the page is current law. 16 has some language from House Bill 2306 starting on line 21 through 30. On to 17, and well, it's on page 17, lines 11 through 14 is language from 2306, the first confirmation. The bold is the dash 5 amendment language that we're looking at. Then lines 25 through 30 on page 17 are House Bill 2306 language. Again, these are all still within the definition section. Page 18, lines 5 through 25 is current law.
What was that? Excuse me.
5 through 25 is current law.
Current law.
Yeah. But we just had to change the numbers. Starting at 26, that's House Bill 2306 language. What protective health information. And then on to page 19 through 5 through 13 is current law. 14 through 16 is House Bill 2306. And then section 2 is the end of that conflict amendment.
Okay.
Back to our dash 5.
And then it's dash 4s from there.
Correct. And then
we've already seen.
Right. And then pages 22 through 24 have conflict amendments with Senate Bill 253, which is a bill that we passed out of this committee, just on the floor, scheduled to be on the floor. And that deals with the term insurance producer. So you'll see the term agent replaced with insurance producer. Okay. Okay, Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 268.
Representative Kitts moves the dash 5 amendment into Senate Bill 268. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Excuse me. We note one objection, Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move Senate Bill 260A as amended to the Committee on Rules with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 260A as amended to the Committee on Rules with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Geiger. Aye.
Representative Berard.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
No.
Representative Shoffler.
No.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Chair
Close? Votes aye. Motion carries. And 260 moves to the Rules Committee. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 260. Okay. Take care of Paul's going next. All right. Going to open work session on House Bill 3322, and this was a bill. Megan, maybe you can refresh our memory what happened on this bill.
Yes, we passed this bill out of committee a couple weeks ago, and it exempts individuals enrolled in apprenticeship programs from the one-week waiting requirement to be eligible for unemployment compensation. It did have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and I know collected to catch that, and we send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we need to address the issue of the referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3322.
Representative Kitts moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3322. Is there objection?
Madam Chair, just a question. Could you give some background to the plan?
To the what?
To the plan. Why are we bringing this one back?
This, we sent it to the floor, and it had a referral to Ways and Means, and we forgot to rescind it.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to bring it back. Other questions? Are there objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Kitts?
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3322 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3322 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Move to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Or to Ways and Means.
Or move it to Ways and Means.
Is there a fiscal on there?
Originally came back with the employment department indicated there might be some, but it might be more. They don't know.
We don't know. I'll move to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3322 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3322 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm just confused. I thought that's what we had done previously.
We sent it to the floor.
We sent it to the floor, and it had a subsequent referral, and we needed to rescind that, and we didn't. And there is a possibility of a fiscal on it.
I thought, and I'm sorry, another question. I thought that I had been told that there was only a minimal fiscal impact to the bill that wouldn't really require it to go to Ways and Means. Do we know? I mean, do we have a fiscal on
it? We don't have a fiscal. The employment called this week and said there may be a fiscal, and something they didn't anticipate earlier because it did come back originally with a minimal fiscal. So we haven't had inclusive information from the employment.
We're voting aye.
Hmm? Okay. Further discussion, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had a lot of time to get a fiscal on this, and my understanding also, this is the first I've ever heard there could possibly be one, and if there is not a fiscal, I'd feel much more comfortable just simply eliminating the subsequent referral and sending it back to the floor.
And Madam Chair, I think the Employment Department might be prepared to tell us something if it's possible, and I see their gurus in the room.
We have a motion on the floor, Representative Rosenbaum. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallego.
Aye.
Representative Berard. Madam Chair, I'm not sure exactly what I'm voting on here.
Okay, House Bill 3322 has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We sent it to the floor. We did not rescind that. Now there's a question of a fiscal. We need to move it to Ways and Means. And that's the motion.
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
No.
Representative
Shoffler? Nope.
Representative
Gallego? You need to vote.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Mayor Klug?
Votes aye. Motion carries.
And Madam Chair, could I just explain my vote? Because I don't believe it does have a fiscal, and I think if we'd had that information, it might not have been necessary to do this. And I'm not sure, Representative Pitts, that you were aware of that.
Well, if I may respond, it's a little perturbing to me that we don't have this information as to whether it does or does not have a fiscal of over $50,000 at this point.
All I can say is that the Speaker put this referral on there, and I need to honor that.
Okay.
So we are closing the work session on 3-3. Okay, where should we get to the next one?
We've got still four.
Okay. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 604, and we'll call Daryl Fuller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller with the Oregon Auditors Association, and I'm here without any children today, so I'll try to be brief. Having run out of kids and having my wife refuse to join me today, so I'm all by myself. Senate Bill 604 is a compromise bill that we've been working on with the manufacturers that alters the franchise law. Franchise law is a part of statute that governs the relationship between auto dealers and auto manufacturers. Senate Bill 604, as amended, makes three minor changes. It adds for the first time a definition of motor vehicle to the franchise law. It modifies the amount of time that a manufacturer has to initiate an audit on a dealer's warranty or incentive programs. And the bill changes the threshold for reporting damage to a new vehicle from $400 to $500. Pretty simple. It has, I said, manufacturers have reviewed it and have agreed to it. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions from the committee? Okay, looks like there are none. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And there is no one else to testify on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 604A. We'll go to a work session on Senate Bill 604A. Representative Kicks.
I would move Senate Bill 604A to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Kicks moves Senate Bill 604 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative Crawford?
Aye.
Representative
Kitts?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
Close? Votes aye. Motion carries, and Representative Gallegos, will you carry the bill?
Sure.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 604A. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 237. Call Rob Edwards of the Employment Department. And Megan has had to step out, so committee, I will read the summary. Revises the amount of bond or deposit that nonprofit employing unit must deliver to the director of an employment department when, instead of paying taxes, the nonprofit employing unit elects to reimburse unemployment compensation trust fund.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Edwards. I'm with the tax section of the employment department. This is a fairly simple change. We just want to update the bond requirements for for reimbursing nonprofit employers. They have not been updated in over 20 years. We're passing out a little bit of information, testimony on the bill. And I'm ready to take any questions you may have.
Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 237, and I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 237. Discussion. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
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 Is excused.
Chair
Close. Votes aye. Motion carries. Representative Schaffler, will you carry this bill?
Thank you.
And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 237. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 207A, and I'm calling Brian DeMarco of the Real Estate Agency. And the summary is, it modifies the provisions relating to licensing, record keeping, bonding, and civil penalties for escrow agents, authorizes the real estate agency to issue limited escrow agent license. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian DeMarco. I'm with the Commissioner's Office at the Real Estate Agency. I'm manager for Land Development and Policy Coordination. I'm circulating 4 pages of written testimony, and rather than going over the details of this bill, which make a number of technical and typographical changes to the current law, I'd just like to discuss a couple components that have the greatest impact on the bill itself. The first important provision modifies pre-licensing qualification and now includes minimal competency requirements. There's a 3-year requirement now for an individual to demonstrate experience in the administration of escrows.
Thank you.
We also have included a requirement for an industry-backed continuing education program. I think the second provision that generates the most impact and concern over the progress of this bill while working with the major stakeholders, the Oregon Land Title Association and the Oregon Escrow Council, is the increase in the amount of bond rate. First of all, the current bond rate floor was established in 1963, and since then, obviously, the increase in real estate has resulted in possible larger losses than were anticipated back in 1963. I think the second reason for the increase in the bond rate has to do with personal financial statements. The law currently requires that the commissioner review the personal financial statements of the escrow agent licensees, as well as their directors, their officers, partners. It's important to review the personal financial statements for the smaller, closely family-owned escrow company. But when it comes to the larger corporations, the personal financial solvency of the individual officer is not really tied into the personal financial or the financial solvency of the larger company. So these officers and directors were required to submit personal financial statements, yet when they were doing so, these personal financial statements became subject to public disclosure law. We found that by shifting the onus to the bonding company obviates the need to require personal financial statements for certain individuals in this case. The bonding company vets the escrow company, and rather than putting the onus on the commissioner to look at personal financial statements of directors or personnel. There are two, this increase in bond did cause quite a bit of concern, especially with the smaller companies. They felt that the several hundred dollars a year or several thousand dollars a year increase would hurt their bottom line, and we had to discuss a number of alternatives so that they didn't necessarily have this onus of an increase in obtaining paying for a bond, or even in the ability of obtaining a bond for whatever reason. In statute right now, there are two exemptions that an escrow agent can satisfy the bonding requirement by putting up a cash deposit. The commissioner can waive the bonding requirement when there's a certain demonstration of a certain level of capital and surplus net worth. In addition, we added 2 further exemptions requiring either a certified annual renewable letter of credit or a certified personal guarantee by the owner. We feel these four exemptions across the board will help obviate the pressing need of some of these escrow companies to come up with the increase in the bond. I think before you, you have an amendment, or you should have amendment, a dash five. This dash five deletes a couple lines from the bill. It was agreed to in the on the other side in the Senate at the time, and it just didn't get into the A and gross. The amendment deletes section 15. At the time, we wanted to delete the escrow agents from a list who can be a trustee of a trustee. Under 86790, they have a whole list of people who are groups who could be a trustee. An escrow agent was one of these. What we found were several, two or three out-of-state companies were coming in qualifying as an escrow agent nominally purely to provide the trustee services. They would come in and get their license, but essentially we would have no regulatory authority over them. They would be escrow agents, but they were not really doing escrow work. So the idea behind deleting the provision in the original bill was to eliminate this possibility. However, it came to our attention at the last moment that there are several Oregon escrow agents who provide trustee services using this specific provision. And by eliminating the provision, we're impacting the bottom line of several escrow, Oregon escrow companies, and we really didn't want to do that. There seemed to be a lack of communication in the escrow industry about the impact of the bill that slipped through the cracks, and then at the last moment, several people raised this issue. So we did agree to delete that provision because it was we were really directing it towards the out-of-state companies, and we will revisit it in a future session. And the agreement was came by all stakeholders in the matter to delete the provision.
So that would be all Section 15, correct?
Correct. Now, I'd be pleased to answer any questions you may have on this.
Brian, can you also tell me 86.790, what is that statute covering that you're deleting?
Okay, 86.790 reads that the trustee of a trustee so and so forth shall be either an attorney, a financial institution, a title insurance company, the United States, or any agency. Currently reads escrow agents, an attorney who's a trustee, and so forth. Most of the escrow companies now qualify under the title insurance part. It was just only a handful that did not conduct title insurance activities who were qualifying under the escrow agent subsection.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I was out of the room when you started your testimony, so you may have answered this already, but on the increase in the bond amount, what will be the effect of that in terms of cost on these agents?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the cost itself, let's see, is rather minimal. I have some testimony here and some interview with an insurance agent. The cost is approximately right now $15 per thousand of the bond. So right now for the lower level for $25,000 you're talking about $375. It would go up appreciably. A $50,000 level now would be approximately $750. If we go up to $125,000 bond, we're looking at approximately $1,800. So it does go up incrementally, but it's not more than several hundred dollars in each case.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. It does seem like a huge jump, Mr. DeMarco, and we're just wondering, that's a doubling, is that correct?
That's correct, in some instances, on the floor.
And again, the testimony on that was, the justification was
30 years, is that correct?
That is correct, the value of real estate. And there have been a number of defalcations in the industry in recent years. What we've been finding is that the larger companies mainly cover these losses. It doesn't go to a bonding process. We've had no claims on bonds. It's just that the bond is there particularly for a company that does not have the financial solvency and resources of a large corporation. And it's to protect the consumer whereby the $25,000 will not likely protect the consumer these days.
I see. Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 207A, and I'm going to open a work session on 207A. Let's see if we can open. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I would move the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 207.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the -5 amendment into Senate Bill 207A. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. Excuse me, is there objection? I'm sorry. Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 207A as amended to the floor with the DFAS recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 207A as amended to the floor with a DFAS recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Gerard.
Aye.
Representative
Merkley.
Aye.
Representative
Joplin.
Aye.
Representative Kemp.
Is excused.
Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Merkley, will you carry the bill? Thank you. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 207A. Okay. Where's our sign-in sheet for this bill? We did 237, yes. This is the only one left. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 40A. We have a number of people to testify. So we are going to time the testimony on this to 3 minutes apiece. We'll have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 40A modifies factors used to determine status of worker as employee or independent contractor. We have a -A2 amendment which modifies what making significant investment in the business includes. Thank you.
Okay, and we'll call Ed Glad. Oh, excuse me. I better call up the phone. Yes. I'm sorry, Ed. Wait, hang on. Okay. So these are the drafters.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll call Jeff Abbott and John Dranius.
Chair Close and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Schoenfeld, and I represent the tax section of the Oregon State Bar. And with me is Jeff Abbott, also representing the State Bar. John Dranius is directly to my left, and Mark Sellers will be testifying very shortly as well. I just wanted to give a brief overview as to why we introduced the bill in the first place. I think the tax section, this is the first time we've ever introduced the bill, but we felt that we had so many clients with problems in the area of determining whether an individual was an independent contractor that it was an area that we really needed to address and to get some resolution. We feel like we have no special interests. We're just representing a broad group of people that we see come in the door day to day with problems in this area. A real reason for introducing the bill in the first place was there's a big divergence in Oregon state law and federal law in determining who is an independent contractor. And that, of course, causes a lot of problems because most individuals will look to the federal law to determine who is an independent contractor. And even though an individual would be an independent contractor under federal law, oftentimes under state law they would be considered an employee. And this, of course, causes a lot of problems because then the business who is hiring this individual doesn't know whether to treat them as an employee or an independent contractor. And so our hope was to try to move these closer together. I think we introduced the bill on the Senate side that originally would have adopted the same definition of an independent contractor as we have for federal purposes. We all acknowledge that that's not a perfect definition at all, but we feel like we need to move closer together and that that's the more appropriate definition and really looks at whether an individual is doing business on their own and has their own authority over how the business is performed. We've worked closely with the employment department in trying to come to a resolution on what we might do on this bill. We've revised it significantly, had several work group sessions, and I'm just going to turn it over to Jeff Abbott since we're short of time, and we'll all try to address the various issues.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Abbott. I'm also a member of the tax section of the Oregon State Bar and also a CPA. Kerry summarized very clearly that we see there is a difference between federal law and state law, and trying and businesses trying to comply with both has become in some cases impossible. For instance, the federal law may require a person to be an independent contractor, and therefore no withholding is made for taxes, Social Security, and perhaps the federal unemployment tax. On the state side, if a determination is made that person's an employee, then that employer, that business is required to withhold state income tax, is required to file and pay unemployment tax. However, you've got this split personality of a worker. In addition, how does that business treat for employee benefits that worker? For federal purposes, they're independent contractors. For state purposes, they're under the current statute may be an employee. You've got the worker himself may have their own retirement plan. Well, they're not allowed to have that under the state law if they're an employee. That worker may deduct certain expenses on a Schedule C. They're not allowed to do that as a worker under the state rule if they're classed as an employee, but they are in the federal rule. One solution has been suggested. Well, why don't we just treat them as employees for federal and state purposes? Well, I think that the worker would have an objection to that, and they have there's no right to do that as a business to withhold taxes and the collection of payroll taxes. Our efforts is to try to bring these closer together. Initially, we had some reaction that there's no problem with the existing statute. We felt it did not address the relationship between the worker and the business. And to back that up, we sent out a little questionnaire to our tax lawyers. Do you have any problems with this statute? Let's get some feedback. And as one of my exhibits to my testimony, I've submitted to you at least 25 emails from them, and from virtually all the major law firms in the state, saying almost unanimously, one exception was an agency attorney, but unanimously saying this is a problem area, and so we're trying to address that to bring it more in line without compromising the policy issues of the collection of unemployment taxes. The process, as Kerry summarized a little bit, was to get together in a work session. All those that were testified at the Senate hearings were numerous and invited for this work session. Many participated. Some, I understand, chose not to. Now I understand there are complaints that we need to have another work session for the next 2 years to address this problem. We think that's disingenuous if they've not participated in the work sessions to begin with. We don't believe it's going to cause an erosion to the collection of employment taxes and the administration of unemployment to those who need it. Those who've been collected on, in part, in sum, have not expected even to get it. They've been treated as independent contractors for federal purposes. And they haven't expected to be treated as an employee for state purposes either.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Sellers. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland. I've been in private practice in the tax area for approximately 22 and a half years in Portland. I represent employers, businesses, individuals in virtually all forms in the state of Oregon. In addressing the merits of this legislation, I would request that the committee look at the actual targets that we're shooting at. In looking at the identity of a person as an employee or as an independent contractor, what we really try to do is to assess the nature of the relationship between the individuals. The initial legislation that we had prepared prior to these work sessions, as Mr. Abbott expressed, was really designed to bring it closer in conformity with the federal law. The federal law is the common law, and if we look at the so-called 20 common law factors that the federal government applies in making this determination, they do look at the relationship between the parties. They look at factors of direction and control. They look at factors of independence. They look at factors of economic risk. And in advising clients, I've always looked primarily at the factor of is this person in control? Does this person, in performing the work, bear the economic risk of a loss? Those are common and familiar concepts that are well known to all businesses. They are uniform in application across the United States, and they are the common denominator that most advisors and their clients utilize in assessing what the treatment is to be for tax and other purposes under the law. If we look at the existing statute 670.600, we find some of those tests. But we also find a bunch of tests that are not based at all upon the relationship between the parties, and they're not directed toward an assessment of the relationship between the parties. They're based upon private conduct of the worker, which may or may not be known to the business. Does the worker have business cards that they hand out? Do they work in a separate area of their home, or do they work at their kitchen table? Do they have a separate telephone for their business? Did they file a Schedule C in their own individual income tax return? None of these factors are necessarily known to the business. What's more, none of them have any bearing upon allocation of risk or a determination of the relationship between the parties. In short, they constitute a trap for the unwary. And the way that these problems arise is that a worker, after years of functioning, may file an unemployment claim. All of a sudden, the unemployment people are on the job with the employer. The Department of Revenue becomes involved, and there's a trap here. We are trying to eliminate the trap. We are not trying to represent any particular constituency. Our goal is to make Oregon a more friendly climate for business development, eliminate risks to employers, implement uniform standards that are easy of comprehension, and also standards that are relevant to the determination of the issue at hand, rather than based upon private, unknown conduct, which really doesn't seem to have any direct bearing upon the determination of the issue. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is John Dranius. I am a tax attorney and a CPA. I was the chair of the taxation section when we began working on this bill several years ago.
John, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure that about 3 minutes would be ample and adequate, and hopefully acceptable.
I'll do my best.
So many. Thank you.
I'll do my best. What we are trying to do, what this proposal does, and this came from a collaborative process among our group. The Employment Department was instrumental in this. They were comfortable with it. They were they had a big hand in writing it. We understand that they're going to oppose it today. We're not quite sure why, but they were happy with it before. We retain we're just streamlining the current statute. We're going to a three-requirement approach with this, where to be an independent contractor, you still must have freedom from direction of control. You still must be an independently established business, as under current law, and you still must have all licensure requirements met that apply to your situation. All we are really doing is taking the cards that are in the existing deck and shuffling them around a little bit more, and trying to organize them in a way where it better reflects modern realities and the way that businesses really operate in today's environment. The bill is a bit difficult to follow. We thought it was formatted a little more understandably before it went to Legislative Council, but now it's a little bit tougher to follow. But we've submitted commentary, which takes you through the bill, and we were hopeful that we can get this into the legislative history that would explain how this bill works. Subsection 1 is the freedom from direction and control requirement, which is exactly the same as under current law. Subsection 1B sets out the independently established business requirement, and subsections C and D are licensing requirements. Very similar to current law. Under the independently established business requirement, there are five factors that are to be addressed, and satisfying any three are sufficient to make out an independently established business. Those are capital letters A, B, C, D, and E. And any three of those five will be sufficient to qualify as an independent contractor. Those target more realistic approaches to defining whether somebody is in a business or not. You know, 12 years ago, 13 years ago, when the current statute was adopted, it was anachronistic for people to work from their homes. Today, there are an enormous number of home-based businesses. They're recognized in the land use law. There are exceptions for home-based business operations in residential neighborhoods. We've eliminated, you know, we've moved away from that black mark of being a worker from your home. We've eliminated the requirement for written contracts. Nobody ever questions my being an independently established business, and I don't have written fee agreements with all my clients. We've eliminated this undue emphasis upon whether or not somebody has a business card, and we've eliminated this question about whether or not you have a separate telephone line for your business, because a lot of home-based businesses by just using their residential line. We are not looking to, and we don't think that this bill would create a significant erosion in unemployment insurance coverage. It's going to simply close this trap that Oregon businesses fall into by thinking they have the situation covered and finding out that they don't. There's been some concern raised by employee leasing organizations. We don't see how this would make any change, that the employees would still be employees of the leasing organization, not the business that uses them. It's not a difficult statute to administer. It's the same factors, it's the same things for the most part that the department is accustomed to seeing, and they are just going to be applying them in a little bit different way. There's no problem with federal conformity. We have a letter from the Department of Labor that raised that issue. The current version of the bill is different from the original version of the bill. Their points were very good ones with respect to the original version, but their concern has been dealt with in the current version, and there is no problem with federal unemployment conformity. Now, we also understand that the Construction Contractors Board is going to propose an amendment, a minor conforming amendment to Section 701. We've seen that, and we think that's fine, and we support that. There is a little technical discrepancy between the two provisions. So unless any of you have any other questions, I'm going to...
When is this? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for anyone who wants to answer it. I understand that you have a lot of technical expertise, but it seems to me that this definition is more than a matter of technical tax or legal interpretation. It's been
pretty carefully crafted over time as a balance between employers and employees. And if we don't have everybody on board right now, as we move forward, and I see that there were 9 no votes in the Senate, so clearly it was not unanimous over there, then I guess I don't understand why we would want to move forward without trying to bring everybody in. If we could, in the interim, have a task force or something that could try to address all those concerns and have a bill that everybody could support, why wouldn't that be a good idea?
Chair Kitz, Representative Rosenbaum's question is a good one. We've tried real hard to get everybody to agree on this. And, you know, what we're faced with is very strong opposition from groups that refuse to participate and refuse to talk to us. Yes, there were 9 nay votes in the Senate. There were 21 aye votes. I mean, in the face of furious lobbying by one of the strongest lobbies in the state, a 70% aye vote in the Senate is, you know, pretty remarkable. There are innumerable businesses in this state that are having just tremendous problems with trying to navigate the course that the current statute sets out. It's not a very good balance. It was when it was adopted, probably. You know, it was just fine when it was adopted, but life has changed. You know, people work out of their houses now. People work independently. They don't, you know, you don't live and die with one employer anymore. You don't spend your whole life working for one company and then get a gold watch and a pension. You know, people are creative. They're more entrepreneurial than they used to be. They don't want to be employees. They want to be self-employed. They want to be on their own because they can make more money doing that.
Madam Chair,
Representative Shoffley.
Sir, with all due respect, I don't think people aren't getting gold watches because this isn't the law. But my question is, actually, it's not even a question, I'm sorry. I've navigated the business world, and I'm not a lawyer or a CPA. It can be done if I can do it. All these good people can do it, too. My wife's a small business person. But as I read this, I have to meet 3 of the 5. And any laborer out there could meet A, B, and C and fall off a roof and break their neck, and they'd be stuck with the risk, and they'd be stuck with paying for their health problems. The way I interpret this, now once again, I'm not a lawyer, but in my opinion, that's what I just said is true. And that opens up, we're not talking about tax lawyers and CPAs and people in front of their computer at home. That's my interpretation of this, and if I'm wrong, forgive me. I'm talking about the laborer out there that doesn't know any better, that isn't seeking a gold watch, that just wants to make a living, and if they get hurt, they want to get some workers' compensation, they get laid off, they want to get some unemployment insurance, all those things that we're worried about here in this building. And please, I'd love to have your response.
Chair Close, I'd be glad to respond. Falling down and breaking your neck and not having any insurance coverage is not the kind of risk that this statute would recognize as meeting the risk requirement. The risk is a business risk. When you're an independent business, you do things and you may or you may not make money on them. It's undetermined how much. I mean, I can't tell you how much money I'm going to make next year. If I'm getting a paycheck and a W-2 from somebody, I can tell you exactly. This doesn't affect workers' compensation coverage at all. That's an altogether separate animal. But all of your rank and file laborers, you know, the regular workers in this state, the people like you, they would never qualify as independent contractors because of subsection 1A. They are not free from direction and control. They are told what to do. They are instructed how to do their work. Let me give you an example. After the Senate hearing, one of the construction union representatives said, you know, he went to a job site and he saw just the other day, and there were 8 guys pushing up a wall. And he says 3 of them were employees and 5 of them were independent contractors. And I just started laughing. I said, sounds to me like he had 8 employees. And he says, no, I know them all. 3 of them are employees, 5 of them are all licensed independent contractors, and that's how it is. I says, you know, that's not possible. There is no way, you know, having 8 people be in the same place at the same time with their hands on the same 2x4s doing the same thing in synchronicity requires a lot of organization, doesn't it? I mean, you didn't have 8 guys walking around all of a sudden say, oh, let's put that wall up. Somebody told them to. And when somebody told them to, they didn't do it out of the goodness of their heart. They didn't do it because they were trying to help some other guy on the job. They did it because they were told to do it and they had to. Well, they are not free from direction and control. If they were, the odds of all 8 of them being there at the same time would have been like this much. And if that's in the statute now, and it's in this bill that we have proposed, it's not changed a bit, and that's where the analysis really ought to be. It shouldn't be whether or not this guy that fell off a ladder had a business card in his back pocket. It should, and it didn't, and it shouldn't be with whether or not he's got Joe Blow contractor telephone listing or, you know, John Doe citizen. It should be, you know, something more directly related to what's really going on. And there's plenty of ammunition here in this statute right now under current law and even under what we've proposed to address those kinds of abuses and take care of people like that.
Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I would just like to respond to what you said. It is possible because my finisher is a contractor. He provides me with workman's comp liability bond information before he helps me. We're both contractors. We switch off on that all the time. The pump guy that shows up is a licensed contractor as well. Everybody on my job site's a contractor, and we all pay the license. We all go through the same process that I've went through. Now, if I want to hire a temp agency or if I want to be signatory with the union, then the temp may pay for the workman's comp, or the union pays for, I pay for the union, or if I'm not in the union, I pay for the workman's comp too. So I'm very worried about this. We had another issue like this. And the way I see it, if you meet these 3, I know what you just said, you're not too worried about it, but I could meet these 3 right here and go out there with my shovel and say, I can dig this ditch. You don't need to be, I don't need a foreman. I don't need a supervisor. You can leave the job site. That is possible. I know it's possible. So that would make me an independent contractor if I'm working unsupervised.
Representative Close, I have no doubt that Representative Schaffler could meet 3 of the 5. I have no doubt either that he could meet 4 of the current 7. It's not that much different. You know, maybe, you know, I'm not telling you there's not one person somewhere in the state that's going to become an independent contractor if this bill passes that wouldn't have been the day before. There's going to have to be a difference. If there's not going to be a difference, why would anybody change the law?
But may I respond to that?
We'll let him finish his sentence.
Yes, ma'am.
But, you know, the 4 out of 7 in that, the four out of those seven causes tremendous problems in other industries. You know, you can't, if you have a bookkeeper that comes in to do your bookkeeping work in your office and he or she uses your computers, that person's an employee. It's a professional person, but they're an employee because they don't provide the tools and the equipment. It goes on and on. Computer programmers. There's so much more in this economy today than the construction trades. But in the construction trades, the 7 that you've got to get 4 of are so easy as it is. It's not a significantly worse situation to have to meet our 3 of 5 rather than the current 4 of 7. Now, you might want to go opposite direction and say you got to meet 10 out of a different 11 or something, but that's another battle for a different day.
I'm not, thank you for that. I'm not concerned about the one individual being able to meet the needs, the requirements. I'm worried about the one employer who demands they meet those requirements to avoid workers' compensation or that's what I worry about. And you know what, sir, with all due respect, there's thousands of unemployed people in Oregon right now who would love to have a job. And if this passes, every single one of them are going to go out there and say, I'm an independent contractor because I got to feed myself and my family. And they're going to be willing to take this risk, the business risk, in order to make a living. And that I'm looking at it from the opposite direction that I believe you folks, you good folks are. That's my concern. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your patience.
Well, Representative Close, that's what they're doing today. You know, it's not that hard to become an independent contractor in the construction trades. And it can be done, but
you have to have insurance.
I misspoke. It's not that hard to become an independently established business under today's statute. But nobody, the unions, the employment department, nobody pays a lot of attention to Section 1A, which is the freedom from direction and control. You know, that is the tool that everybody ought to be using. When the unscrupulous employer hires you and says, look, buddy, you want to make a living? Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go do this, and you're going to show up at 8 o'clock or 6 o'clock, and you're going to do this, and you're going to be an independent contractor, and everything's going to be just fine. There is so much direction and control going on there that's what everybody ought to be looking at, not the business cards and the telephone listings.
I agree with that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, one more question, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are two things that stand out to me as I look at this. First, you're testifying that the key to this is really clarification of freedom from direction and control, and yet that seems to be the same in existing law and in the bill you're proposing. So if that is a key part of the problem, this bill doesn't seem to address that. That's the first half of my question. The second half is you've laid out a problem where people are trapped between the federal law and the state law. And yet, as I think about those three columns, if you will, the current federal standards, the current state standards, and the proposed state standards, it still seems to me that there's significant differences between the federal and your proposed state standards, and it's leaving us in much the same quandary. So those are the two main things. Can you just clarify for us what's going on?
Yes, sure. Representative Close, the comments are good ones. We have to take the freedom from direction and control element of this as a given. That is the federal rule for tax purposes. They've amplified it into the 20-factor test, but that is the rule, virtually verbatim. It is also the federal unemployment insurance law. That's the definition under unemployment insurance, and if we deviated from that standard, we would lose federal funding for unemployment coverage. So we're stuck with all of its warts. We're stuck with this freedom from direction and control standard. But it's a good one because it's premised upon the common law evolvement of law as to master and servant, employer, employee, and it's the common law approach to defining whether or not somebody is an employee. So we're not changing it because we don't want to change it, and if we did, we'd have a lot of problems with being out of whack in the opposite direction versus federal law. The independently established business requirement is the significant difference between Oregon law and federal law. And, you know, we started out with the original version of the bill just picked up federal law and eliminated that requirement altogether. And, you know, there was all kinds of controversy over that. It was really a hotly disputed thing. And that's where we went to work in the work group and crafted a compromise. And that's what we have now is a compromise. We started out wanting to just eliminate that requirement altogether. There are a lot of reasons why Oregon has a historic policy of being more stringent about this than necessary under federal law and looking for this independently established business requirement. So what we thought our strategy was, you know, if we can't eliminate it, then let's at least rewrite it in a way where it makes some sense. You know, where it looks at things that looks at definitions. You know, it is a definition of an independent business. And independent businesses today are not the same as they were 13 years ago or 50 years ago. So we've got a more modern definition. It's a more understandable definition. People can look at it and they can read it and they can understand it. As soon as you figure out where in the statute it is, you can read it and understand it. And it's something that you can predict. So we haven't made state and federal law exactly the same, but we've made, if this is passed, we've made state law easier to understand and easier to comply with.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And I do want to say that I think this is an important issue, and I'm glad that the work group spent the time on this, and it is our hope that we can come up with something that everybody can agree with. But I do want you to know we appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next we'll call Tom Byerly, Craig Smith, Bill Boyd. Gentlemen, we have about 15 minutes left for this bill, and we do have two others, so thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. On my right is Bill Boyd. We'll be very, very brief. The board has no position on this, the important policy issues before you in this bill. We have discovered a minor, or really, actually, more of a significant conflict with 701, our licensing statute.
Excuse me, Representative Gerard has a question.
What board? Sorry, the Construction Contractors Board.
And, committee, you are getting a proposed amendment passed out to you from the Construction Contractors Board right now. Please continue.
That conflict would, if this bill went in as written in gross, would prevent the Construction Contractors Board from licensing corporations and LLCs from that point forward. That minor problem could be corrected with these proposed amendments. We offer those to you, and we regret we were more timely in discovering this conflict.
Craig, but just briefly, the topic that they're covering, are you generally in support of the idea behind the bill, but you're offering an amendment to it, is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you that the board did not discuss Senate Bill 40. They're neutral on the bill. We only have a problem with the operational provision that would prevent us from licensing businesses.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Bill Boyd is here to answer any questions if you have any on this. He wrote the proposed amendment, and if you have no questions, then we stand addressed.
Are there questions on this amendment brought by the Construction Contractors Board? Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Byerly, the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. I'm here today to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 40A. We have been working with the proponents of the bill, and we have overcome the conformity issues raised by the U.S. Department of Labor. However, after reviewing the latest language of the bill and comparing it to our contested cases that we had in the year 2002, we still believe that there's going to be a real good chance for erosion of worker coverage as well as some administrative costs as we administer the new language. So it is our hope that we could have an interim work group just further study this and to come up with a better proposal that we could all work with and, again, maintain worker coverage as we think it should be.
Tom, this work group that was going on, were you part of that work group?
I was not personally, but I had staff there, and it was we worked with them at least four, maybe five times.
And was that done during the interim?
It was done this session.
So since January?
Since January, yes. That's correct.
Questions? Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, have you discussed your concerns with the governor's office, and do you know if they have a position on this bill?
We have shared our concerns with the governor's office. The governor submitted a letter to the Senate on April 30, sharing his concerns. And basically, the letter from the governor, if I could quote that, Madam Chair, is that...
Sure.
I have stated I will not support any legislation that could result in federal component problems for state agencies, which we have overcome with the work group studies. That could result in substantial erosion of unemployment insurance coverage for Oregonians. It could result in an increase in administrative costs to state agencies. I believe there may be erosion of unemployment insurance coverage for Oregonians under the proposed changes. I'm not satisfied that SB 40A engrossed will not increase the administrative costs of state agencies. That's just one paragraph from the bottom of the April 30 letter.
Tom, did the Senate take action based on that letter?
They passed the legislation is all I know.
But did these amendments that we have from the Senate, were they in the Senate amendments, were they in response to the letter?
I think Madam Chair, I believe the amendments were done before the letter was submitted to the floor.
Okay. Questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. To clarify your point, you said as you review the cases where there are discrepancies, that as written, this is not going to solve those discrepancies?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, we reviewed our contested cases from calendar year 2002 where independent contractor status was an issue. And we compared what the action we took on those cases as how it would result from the new language. And 25% of those cases that we reviewed would end up being independent contractors, whereas under the current statute, we found them to be employees, and then they were covered for unemployment insurance purposes.
Madam Chair, can you give us an example of the type of case where that transition occurs?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm not sure.
Either the clause in the bill that is driving that or the type of work that transitions from employment to contractor status?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm Rob Edwards from our tax section. I'd like to turn it over to him to address that question.
For the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Edwards. I'm with the tax section of the Employment Department. The contested cases where we saw under the proposed legislation that the person would be an independent contractor rather than an employee were mainly where they were performing those services for a single person. They didn't have an independently established business in the sense that they were performing services for multiple clients or multiple businesses. The example of a bookkeeper who comes in and uses your computer, but they were only doing your books. They weren't doing books for anybody else during the year. Therefore, we said you do not have an independently established business and you are an employee.
I'm sorry, we are out of time on this panel. Thank you very much. I want to give Ed Gladden and Tim Nesbitt a chance to speak. Please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing in opposition to the bill. All of you received a general letter from us at the start of the session in which we covered a range of issues, but we at that time called your attention to our concern about erosion of coverage under unemployment insurance and workers' compensation insurance for any workers in our current workforce. We now have this bill in front of us, and that remains our major concern. We submit that the language in current law, established in 1989, has served us well and, in fact, has provided less problems than you'd have if you attempted to follow other standards or attempted to follow the federal law. By the way, only four states, I believe, follow the federal definition of independent contractor. 46 do not. And in rebuttal to some of the testimony I heard previously this morning, I don't think we've seen a qualitative change over the last 13 years since 1989 when we adopted this law in the nature of the workforce. We may see more workers working as independent contractors, but we're not seeing a different kind of worker. And I think the criteria we see in current law continues to serve as a good test for who's a worker and who's an independent contractor and who's entitled to those basic worker benefits of unemployment insurance and workers' compensation coverage. I also want to challenge the idea that what you're looking at in this bill is now one major test about direction and control and then five others. In fact, there are seven other tests in this bill because of ORs inserted in the language. If you look at criterion A, that's an OR, that's really two criteria. And if you look at criterion C, there's an OR in there too, which actually establishes seven different criteria, any three of which would serve to qualify an individual as an independent contractor. And we think the scope and application of these criteria could, as you heard from the Employment Department's testimony, seriously erode the number of workers in our workforce who are now covered by unemployment insurance and workers' compensation benefits. All a person would have to show beyond this direction and control criterion is that he or she is providing labor or services in the individual's own name or business name, the business card again, assuming a risk of loss related to business or performance, which means being paid by commission or for piecework, and has made a significant investment in the business, which means buying your own tools. So a business card, piecework, buying your own tools could serve to categorize someone as an independent contractor. But our biggest concern is that by changing these criteria in this way, no one can tell us for sure how many workers and what kinds of workers would be excluded from coverage in the future. You heard the Employment Department estimate that maybe a quarter of their contested cases, a quarter of their audited cases. That's the only audit employers covering about 5,000 workers a year. We have 1.5 million workers in Oregon, and no one can tell us what proportion of those workers would be excluded from these basic benefits by these changes in the law. That's why we declined to participate in the work group that was convened over the last couple of months, because we didn't see how, when making changes of this kind, we are changing the criteria, we could adequately assess the scope and the impact of these changes. We also don't think the changes are warranted, to be honest. But I think there's something of a tempest in the teapot over who participated and who didn't. If there's further effort with enough time for the Employment Department to look at the range of workers affected and the number of workers who might be excluded, we would like to see that happen. And in fact, we would be a lot more comfortable with a effort made, first with a different approach, a kind of a notwithstanding these criteria that we have now, here are the exceptions. We'd be a lot more comfortable with that kind of approach, number one. And number two, with an adequate impact assessment of who would be affected and what kinds of workers and how many of them would no longer be covered by these benefits and protections. That's not the approach taken by this work group. That's why we declined to participate. If you feel there are specific problems of the kind that can be addressed by kind of very specifically identifying the kinds of independent contractors who you think need exemption now who didn't need exemption in 1989, that's a different approach. We will be willing to participate in an approach that goes in that direction, but we remain convinced that the law we have now has served us well, and we're very wary of the kinds of changes proposed in Senate Bill 48.
Thank you, Tim. The specific instances that were brought up, talking about eight people on a job and five of them are independent contractors, you say you're happy with the current law, but would you acknowledge there's a problem there?
If I could defer to my colleague at Grad who represents construction workers, I think he could answer that better in terms of that question. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Ed Glad. I'm with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I've been a working carpenter for over 20 years, not only in the state of Oregon for the last 16, but also in the state of Washington, as well as in Washington, D.C., and in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The independent contractor statute that we have currently in the state of Oregon actually does a good job in defining who an independent contractor is. The enforcement of that law is the problem. The ability for us to recognize who is an independent contractor as the work is proceeding does not actually come to light until there is an accident. So, for example, as you just quoted the previous testimony about the five independent contractors and three employees, there is no problem in that situation in terms of compensation for the workers until the 2x4 that was not correctly nailed together to the top plate falls out and the wall falls down. The risk that was taken on paper as an independent contractor or as an employee doesn't become a substantial risk for the worker, the person who is creating the wealth for the employer, the owner, and the purchaser of the services, until there is an accident. Earlier in the session, you heard testimony from Bob Shiprock, who described the person is working as a is working as an independent contractor until he falls off the roof, and by the time he hits the ground, he's an employee. We attend our jobs with risk, but the risk is not in bookkeeping. We attend our jobs at risk because our lives are in danger, our limbs, our fingers, our toes. That's what the risk is. To redefine this, we meet as craftsmen. Every single one, excuse me, not every single one, everyone except for E, the ability to hire and fire, as independent contractors. So we substantially would be, as if you look in the amendment here, it says, is considered to perform the labor services as an independent contractor. So the dilemma that we face as craftsmen to show up on the job is that we will be considered an independent contractor. And if the employer, who we, as Representative Schaffler pointed out, who we are desperate to go to work for, especially in down times like now, says, you will be an independent contractor, well, I don't have a license, I say. He says, go get a license. And if I am an illiterate, which a lot of craftsmen are, they're great mechanics, they're very capable, but they're not capable of passing a test in which to become a contractor, then, essentially, we're saying, you can't be employed on this job. So they come back, and they say, I will take the risk to declare myself an independent contractor, and hopefully the wall won't fall on me. It is a tax problem for sure, as we've heard described today. But in the end, in the construction industry, it becomes a liability problem for every person who's going out to work to feed their families. And we are asking you, please, if there is something to be discussed about the independent contractor definition, send it back to a large working group with lots of different people from lots of different sectors of the industry, including the tax lawyers, to say, how can we solve this problem? I think Governor Kulongoski has asked for that in one of the letters that's in your files. I believe that there is a lot of room to discuss this. The crafts were not necessarily invited. I certainly was not informed, invited, or participated in that work group during the session. I think that there is a lot of discussion to happen to not only define who's an independent contractor and who's an employee, but also how we're going to enforce that to ensure that those people who reasonably show up at work with just the tools on their hips, the truck that they showed up in, and the willingness to go to work are not abused either in the workers' comp arena or in the unemployment insurance arena. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. We appreciate your testimony. That concludes the people to testify on this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 40A. Committee, we have a number of concerns on this bill. There are people that would like to draft amendments. I think we have a good concept here, but we don't have a perfect bill, so we will not be going to work session on the bill at this point. And thank you, everyone. A very fascinating presentation from everyone. Appreciate your work. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2356A.
And committee, this is a bill we pulled back from the floor, and we've already had testimony on it. It's oversight on allowing cities to buy electric companies. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2356A to the Committee on Rules.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2356A to the Committee on Rules. Did you have a recommendation on it?
With a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I still have major concerns about this bill, and it seems to me that the city has indicated a lot of willingness to work with the sponsor of the bill to address a number of his concerns. I know discussions have been ongoing, I think, since it left this committee. So I'm wondering why do we still, is this bill still needed, and why is it going to the Rules Committee?
In my opinion, whenever a city takes this large of a step, because it affects the whole state, the legislature should approve it. So that is why. Further discussion. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding, I don't know if the sponsor of the bill is here, but I'd certainly appreciate a clarification, but my understanding, when the good representative from Morrow County stood up on the floor and talked about this bill and why we were bringing it back off the floor, was that he stated that he was satisfied with the dialogue that had taken place between Portland and Morrow County. My understanding is he went out and met with the commissioners in Morrow County, that he went out and met with the port of Morrow County, that the commissioners in Morrow County had indicated to him that there was no longer a purpose for this bill. That is my understanding, and I'd be happy to have him clarify that. And the city did agree to as part of those dialogues, to provide for payments in lieu of property taxes and to be involved in intimate consideration of the other significant issues that would be raised. In my mind right now, there are a number of enterprises considering the purchase of this particular company, and to have a bill that addresses only one of those suitors really is an unfair situation. And just the fact that it would still be alive after the sponsor had pulled it off the floor, it to me is inappropriate. And I would ask that we simply leave the bill here in committee and let it die. If the sponsor feels it needs to be resurrected, then he could come and ask us to resurrect it.
Representative Merkley, Representative Smith is aware of this move. Morrow County has received a lot of input. However, there are other counties that have not, and so we still have the concern. Representative Gallegos.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd just like to express that there are a lot of people who pay their electric bill to PGE, Washington County, Clackamas County, people in Marion County. It's a very large Fortune 500 company that a lot of us depend on for electricity, and a lot of us have a stake in it, and not everybody's been brought to the table necessarily until the deal's done. It's important that all of us have the opportunity to weigh in as in our counties and the people that are going to be affected by it. And it's going to be an important piece of oversight that we should have, and the citizens need to hold in their pocket to just keep moving forward as we need it.
We are not going to do double comments, Representative Merkley. Anyone else? Representative Garrard?
Madam Chair, my interpretation of this is we're not giving anybody our approval other than just permitting a negotiation to go forward, and then that, should anything develop out of that, would still have to be approved by the legislature.
Correct.
All right.
Other discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
No.
Representative Stoffler?
No.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Chair
Close? Votes aye. Motion carries. 2356 moves to the Rules Committee. And I'll close the work session. Okay, we have one more bill, Senate Bill 896. I'm opening a public hearing. I'm calling forward those who can tell us about this bill, John Powell and John DiLorenzo.
Well, I think
only if they are.
turn that into a PUD.
And staff are written summary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 896 modifies laws governing the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. There's some -3 amendments in your packets that modifies what a covered claim does not include by deleting language provisions regarding third-party claims by a third-party claimant whose net worth exceeds $25 million. And I understand there may be some other additional amendments. Thank you.
Good morning.
This is
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. The Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association is a statutory creature created by the legislature, and other states have similar types of guarantee associations. The purpose of the association is to fill in up to a dollar cap level for claims that come about after an insurance company is declared insolvent and put into liquidation. The board is comprised of individuals from the insurance industry who is then assessed by their market share to pay the claims of the people who are injured in those ways. Senate Bill, and with me today is Tom Mortland with Liberty Companies, North Pacific in particular, and John Langslet, the attorney who advises the association. Senate Bill 896 has 8 primary components that we had suggested to the legislature that they that be brought up to date and clarified. And Madam Chair, looking at the time, and given the status of this bill, should I just talk to what we really, given the controversy that's developed, should I talk to that controversy or should I go over the bill since we're basically asking that our bill be withdrawn?
John, I just wanted, since we did have it on the agenda, you to have a chance to give a few remarks. You can go into as much as you want. We don't have agreement on the spill committee, and I thought that you should be aware that we did try to come to agreement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we have worked with at least one or two interests who had some concerns about the language. We worked with them and do have some amendments that I think we had agreed to, but there are other amendments that we cannot agree to and would not agree to, and as a consequence, rather than put the committee through that kind of understanding the 8 principal components of the bill and the amendments we've agreed to, and then debate this other issue, would take, I know, more time of the committee's time, and as a consequence, we have offered simply to withdraw Senate Bill 896.
Thank you. Other comments? Okay. Thank you very much. And we'll give John a chance to speak to the same bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the Davis Wright Tremaine firm. I'm appearing here today on behalf of my client, Parsons, Farnell, and Grine, in support of amendments to Senate Bill 896. We understand that the insurance industry would rather see no bill than a bill which contains one of the amendments which we have proposed. But we would like to leave it to the committee as a policy choice to decide
what should be done with the bill in light of the amendment. Senate Bill 896 is passed by the Senate, modifies laws which govern the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. The association is created to provide relief to policyholders who find themselves with valid claims against insolvent insurers. The bill, which was sponsored at the behest of the insurance industry, significantly pares back protections that are afforded to policyholders by the association. My client is an offshoot of my former law firm, Hagen Dye Hershey and DiLorenzo, and Mike Farnell, who's with me today, is one of my former law partners who represents the trustees of various pension plans that had invested pension funds in various capital consultants, funds, and investments. The collapse of these funds and investments were generally referred to as the Jeff Grayson Capital Consultants matter and gained great notoriety several years ago. A number of actions were filed by parties, including the United States Department of Labor, and class actions were filed by pensioners who lost substantial amounts of money in their pension plans. The Bullivant-Hauser Bailey firm represented the trustees in the defense of these actions. My former firm, through Mr. Farnell, represented the trustees in their efforts to obtain coverage from various insurers to help fund the settlements which were ultimately reached in the case with the class plaintiffs, the Department of Labor, and other parties. The entire matter was referred to mediation by Federal Judge Gar King. After months of deliberations, Ninth Circuit Judge Edward Levy announced a settlement between all of the parties concerned. These settlements were funded in large part due to Mr. Farnell's efforts and from various insurers who wrote fiduciary liability insurance policies. One of the insurers, Legion Insurance, agreed to pay $578,000 to settle one action, $3,738,000 to settle another, and $5,250,000 to settle another action. After agreeing, and that was one of many insurers, after agreeing to the settlement terms and on the eve of the deadline for funding the settlements, Legion entered into insolvency proceedings. The Insurance Commissioner of Pennsylvania placed Legion Insurance into formal rehabilitation. On March 29, 2002, Federal Judge King issued findings and an order finding Legion in default of its obligations under the settlement agreements. Judge King ruled that the trustees, the class action plaintiffs, the Department of Labor, and the people of the state of Oregon had a compelling interest in the consummation of the settlements, and therefore ordered Legion to immediately pay the sum of $9,567,000 to the federal court. The Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner refused to honor the federal court order. On May 24, 2002, Judge King found the Insurance Commissioner of Pennsylvania in contempt of the federal court. Instead of honoring the payment obligation, the Insurance Commissioner appealed Judge King's contempt order to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Neither Legion nor the Insurance Commissioner have yet to make the agreed-upon settlement payment, and thousands of union pensioners have yet to recognize and realize the benefits of this component of the overall settlement. I have attached Judge King's initial findings and orders as an exhibit to which follows the Hand and Groves version of the bill in the exhibits which you have. Now, we believe that Senate Bill 896, of course, in its current form, would have greatly prejudiced these pensioners by significantly reducing the obligations of the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association to pay the liquidated claims against this insolvent insurer. That is for a number of reasons, which I've listed in my testimony. But in light of the offer of the insurance industry to withdraw the bill, I would instead like to concentrate on why we think, regardless, some amendments are in order. First
John,
of all,
I want you to know we did not distribute the dash twos because there was not agreement. Is that correct?
I just got them this morning.
Yeah.
Well, there are dash two amendments, and I have incorporated them into a hand-engrossed version of the bill, which is in your exhibit package. And so maybe I can just tick through those very quickly and explain what those are.
In the interest of time, I believe we have to be on the floor in 5 minutes, so
okay,
we'll need to summarize quickly.
Let me talk about the most significant amendment. The most significant amendment is number two in my testimony, and it provides that there is a trigger to the payment by the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. And normally, the association will only pay when a court has approved an order or a plan of rehabilitation or an order of liquidation. We are suggesting that the Guarantee Association should pay when there has been an order of rehabilitation in effect for more than 1 year without approval of a plan by a court in the insurer's domicile. The purpose of the amendment is to guard against the circumstance which we face with respect to Legion. It has not paid its claims. An order has been in effect for over a year, is likely to be in effect much longer. Exacerbating the situation is the insurance commissioners being in contempt of court. These petitioners should not have to wait for the dust to settle in Pennsylvania before they obtain redress under these settlement agreements. We've also provided provision for the insurance commissioner or for the association to step into their shoes and to obtain whatever is left once the order of rehabilitation is finalized. Now, I realize our wish to proceed with this bill as amended in conclusion has created some angst and has possibly offended a person who I deeply respect, but I feel an obligation to these pensioners who have lost so much to try to do the right thing by them. And so ultimately, we leave this matter to you. We're available to answer any questions if you have them.
Questions for John?
I do have a question.
Representative Shoffler.
Dash two amendments, legal counsel printed them out.
Actually, we do have them, but we haven't copied them because we did not have agreement, so we are not doing a work session on this bill.
Okay.
If we were to go to work session, you would have them.
Thank you.
But John says that in his exhibits,
right,
they are their hand and clothes.
Yes, they do.
Other questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you. John, as you were describing it, it sounded, when you said you have an obligation to the pensioners, and yet the amendment you're describing, isn't that setting a standard going into the future rather than addressing your particular case?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that's true. It's a rule of general application. However, there aren't many circumstances in which an insurer becomes insolvent and years go by before there is a formal plan approved by a court. There may be others, but this is a very extraordinary circumstance. Regardless, we think it is a good policy if the purpose of the Guarantee Association, which the statute provides, is to expedite the payment to claimants from insolvent insurers. We think this amendment certainly furthers that purpose.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48. And I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong bill. I apologize. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 896, and that completes our schedule committee. We do have a committee scheduled for Monday, and it will be at 10 o'clock because we were late posting, and so you do have to come back again to this wonderful committee. You get to sleep in Monday.
We get you.
We are adjourned.
You said scheduled for Monday.
10 o'clock.
Megan, 10 o'clock.